And hello everyone, and welcome to the Domain Specific Languages Developers Conference, or the DSL DevCon. This is actually the sixth DevCon. I did the math. The last one was something like 6 years ago, so it's been a while. So thanks for coming out. I appreciate it. My name is Chris, and I am a Microsoft employee, but there are people from all walks of life here, all operating systems, to talk about DSLs from all different kinds of places. So I'm actually very excited. We have thrown in some Microsoft technology because they pay the bills. But other than that, it's a kind of a cross-industry kind of a deal. Our sponsors, of course, and our host, our kind host, is Microsoft. Pluralsight has been kind enough to provide some freebies that we'll be giving out during the conference. That'll be pretty cool. And Addison Wesley has sent us some books, and we'll be giving those out as well. So that's really great. Thanks to those folks. This kind of event does not happen all by itself. There is a lot of people that go into doing this kind of thing. We have our marketing folks who let you kind folks know that such an event was happening. And I'm just curious where people heard about this. Did people hear about this on like banner ads on websites somewhere? No, nobody? Did people hear about it on my blog? MSDN. Couple of folks. MSDN. Great. Okay. Good. Yes. Good. Kent. Yes. Thank you. Great. Okay. Great. A logistics person, our concierge, our my right-hand woman, Tanya outside. She is fabulous. She made all the details happen. She made this lovely room happen, and the wireless, and the power, and the food, and really the fact that we can be here at all is all her. So when you see her, thank her. She's the greatest. I'm a big fan. The art, you'll see it on the T-shirts. That's pretty cool. We'll be giving those out later today. You'll see. That was Steven. And I'm just the pretty face man. I got nothing. And this is as pretty as it gets, too, so kind of out of luck. Okay. Special thanks. Also, I don't know, how many of you went to lang.net earlier in the week? Was that good? Was that a good conference? Yes? What was good? What was the good talk there? What was the knock it out of the park talk? Which one? Code contracts? What else? Anything? Yeah.
Lars.
Lars? Sure. Who doesn't love Lars? Absolutely. Okay. Cool. Great. Well, luckily, all of those talks will be up on the web, so I can see the ones I missed. And all of these talks will be recorded and put up on the web as well, so you can see, I'll see them live. But your friends and colleagues, the jealous many who didn't get to come. In fact, I was turning folks away even up till this week who wanted to come. So those people get to see it. Some logistics. We are going to be having a talk every hour on the hour for the rest of the day today until and then all day tomorrow. Someone have, can I borrow your proceedings here for a second, sir? So if you open it up, there's the schedule right there on the second page. That's the exact same schedule that was on the web for the last couple of months. Of course, at 1 is Martin, and then every hour all day long until 5, the last talk today. On Groovy, which I'm very much looking forward to. And then we have a reception, beer, finger foods, that kind of thing, at 6. And then at 6:45, we'll have the speaker panel. So we'll have all the speakers up here, and they'll have microphones, and you can pepper them with questions. And specifically, if you look further in your packet, you will see a piece of paper. Where is it? 2 pages forward. Is it 2 pages? There it is, the panel question. So this is where you get to write some question that you want the panel of speakers, this august body, DSL speakers, vendors, practitioners, right, the guys that are doing the DSL work on the cutting edge. If you have questions for them, write it down here. And then we will give away. So what happens is I will ask the questions of the panel based on the ones I pick. And in the order that I pick them, I will be giving away the books and the other kinds of things that we have to give away. So write lots of questions, write good questions, and then the ones that I pick, you will get the chances to get whatever it is you want that we're giving away, and a bunch of books, and you'll see those later. Okay? And then, so that's at 6:45, and that goes for as long as you guys have questions to ask our panel. And then tomorrow we start right up again. Meals are at wherever it says there in the schedule. No lunch today. but tomorrow we have breakfast at 7:30 and lunch at 11:45. Okay, so that's just some details. Oh, don't let me steal your proceedings, sir. Around the corner are the facilities. I can rely on the innate ability of humans to find porcelain when they need it, but it's around the corner. Phones. I'm sure everyone has a phone. How many people have phones in this room? Couple people? Yeah, turn them off. Or at least, you know, on that pleasant vibrate mode, right? That's fine, too. I don't care. That's fine. T-shirts we will be giving out this evening at the reception. Those of you who are Microsoft employees, please wait for our non-Microsoft people to grab T-shirts first. I want to make sure everyone has one. There should be enough for everyone. I just want to make sure. Okay? I told you about the panel question, wireless. There's the wireless access password there. Anyone having trouble with wireless can let me know, and I can fix that for them, or I can get them in the right way. And then also in your proceedings are the evaluations. So do me a favor, and as you see each talk, keep track of what was great and write little comments. And this helps us make the content for DevCons in the future better. It helps make the speakers better. So please give us your feedback. Okay, so those are just some logistics. Great. So a tradition at all of the DevCons, now that we have six of them, this is a real tradition, is that I always like to say some of the cool, fun stuff. For example, there are like people from 15 different countries around the world in this room right now, which is amazing to me. In this economy, that people could travel from all over the world for this little conference is pretty cool. So some other fun facts that I will give you. There are 150 speakers and attendees registered for this conference. If the food service is slow, please do not use the ketchup on the countertop. Tani doesn't like that at all. Okay. 50 of them are Microsoft attendees. Those of you with empty seats next to you, those are Microsoft attendees that are off having meetings or drinking coffee or whatever they do. They like to sign up for things and not deliver. Wait, no, that's not us. We would never do such a thing. No. So 50 of them are Microsoft employees. 3 of them are Adobe employees. They sent me this picture. They swore it was not touched up in any way. One attendee from Linden Labs. This is actually a real street that somebody painted that I liked. I like that. I think that's cool. 26 are architects. Yeah, that's me. That's totally me. No, it's not. 11 of them are managers. 2 of them are students. Theodore and Thomas. Theodore, Thomas, where are you? Are we here? Theodore or Thomas? Thomas? All the way from Charles University in Prague. I don't know where you got the money, but I want to talk to you about funding after. Great. And Theodore in the room somewhere? Theodore, good. Good, good. Okay. There is one dude attendee. I asked you for your professional titles, and one of you said, dude. Scott Allen? Yes, there's our dude right there. Actually, you kind of, yeah. Wow. I'm just curious, Scott, where the title dude, was this like officially bestowed? Do you have business cards that say?
I made it up just for this conference.
Did you? That's amazing. Great. Great.
I think Ted might have something to say about that.
Yeah, we're currently in litigation over this.
Sorry to hear that. There's one Microsoft speaker. And in this crowd, I don't know if he's the tiger or the guy with the ponytail. But Paul right there, Paul. Yep, there's Paul, our one Microsoft speaker. Literally, we have one Microsoft speaker. We're on the Microsoft campus. Don't tell anyone that signs the checks. And the number one DSL DevCon fun fact is I have no idea what the next DevCon topic will be. These conferences happen because because I'm a big fan of alliteration. Somebody at the last PDC walked up to me, Don XML, Dom Demshak. How many people know Don? Don walked up to me and he said, "Dude, DSL DevCon." I went, "Oh, we have to throw it now because we got the name, right?" So here we are, because I'm a big fan of alliteration. I don't know what the next one will be, but when I know, you'll know. And for those of you who are keeping track, was it 2003, 6 years? It's been a while, so. All right, now, the man who needs no introduction, the one you're actually here to see, I'm just filling time until he's ready, weighing in at 175 pounds, all the way from England, the Duke of DSLs, Martin Fowler.
I got them all warmed up for you.
Yeah, I noticed. They're just throbbing with excitement. So what I thought I'd do is, rather than actually do any work and come up with something interesting or original, I would just grab my usual deck of slides that I've been using a few times to introduce DSLs to people who perhaps aren't quite sure what they are, and spin it with a kind of slightly different talk to go with it. So that's why I've referred to it as a meta introduction, because I'm going to talk about the introduction and how I try to introduce DSLs to people rather than actually trying to introduce DSLs to you, because I'm assuming you don't need any introduction to DSLs. If you do, I've screwed up. So this is basically the talk I'll give. I don't know whether I will run out of time simply because of I usually do an hour and Chris has only given me 45 minutes, but that doesn't matter anyway. I'll just stop when he pulls the chain. Okay, so the first point I like to make when I'm giving this talk is that DSLs are not a new idea. They have been around for ages. We use them in our regular work. Almost any time we do software, we use half a dozen DSLs. We don't think very much about it, but I end up with these couple of questions in my head, which is, well, you can read them there. Can we do them better? Can we use them more often? Maybe if we did them better and were more efficient about doing them, we would use them more often. And that is really the thing that's kind of triggered my interest in domain-specific languages. I tend to like topics that are old and well understood by a small amount of people, but not well understood by people at large, because that way I don't actually have to do any original work. All I've got to do is take other people's work, repackage it, put a bow on it, and deliver it out. Much easier that way. And one day I might have to do some original work on something, but I'm hoping to keep pushing that day off into the distance. So my aim is to provide this introduction. Now, when starting to give the talk, and indeed the book that I've been working on for 2 years now, 2 years and counting, what I do like to start with is with an example. And I did this actually when I first started working on the refactoring book, because I just went to too many talks where people would talk about broad principles and things, and I'd kind of not really be following what's going on, waiting desperately for an example, because then something would become concrete. Because I think generally a large amount of human beings, not all of them, probably not even the majority in this room, actually like something concrete and then generalize from that, rather than come up, think of something abstract and then try and concretize it. I'm certainly the give me something concrete and I'll abstract up the wazoo kind of person. So I start by working through some kind of example. Now, when selecting an example, and this is jumping ahead from where we are on the slide sequence a bit, what I thought I wanted to do is I wanted something that was, that feels like you're programming, but not in the usual way in which we program with imperative languages. And at the same time, I wanted it to be something fairly familiar. And I ended up going with the notion of a state machine. The state machines are pretty familiar. Lots of people have come across them and used them, perhaps even implemented some kind of state machine thingy at some point in their lives. They're quite amenable to use with a domain-specific language. And it's also the extra bonus that people who are heavily into graphics and graphical DSLs like to imply that you can't do a state machine if you don't have graphics. And in fact, you can describe state machines quite well without graphics. I mean, it's not quite as good, but still reasonably. And I think that makes a nice little point as well. And again, I've stolen from others. The Microsoft DSL Tools book uses a state machine. The MetaEdit book uses a state machine. So hey, if it worked for them, it might as well work for me. However, the problem with state machines is that whenever anybody illustrates a state machine, they always seem to use something like cruise control systems for cars, which I found particularly irritating when I lived in England, because we don't have cruise controls in our cars in England, so the examples were always a bit hard to follow. So ages ago, when I wrote UML Distilled, I decided I'd use something else, and I decided the idea of the way in which you'd access secret panels in those really bad movies that we watched as kids. You know, where you've got to kind of switch on this light and pull this lever and kick this thing here, and you do the right things in the right kind of sequence and the secret panel opens. That would make a much better example of a state machine, much more interesting one than the usual ones. So that's what I use as my example, a secret panel rendered as a state machine. I definitely went from the I want a state machine, now let's give me an example for that. Of course, like any example, it has to be really, really simple because people have got to be able to comprehend it in all one go. Anyway, moving on to the example. So we go through basically a sequence of things, close the door, open the drawer, turn on the light. Those two can happen in any order, and then you open up the state machine. And the state machine basically looks like this. So we have a standard state machine with states and events. Two things I always point out when I talk about the state machine is that, one, it's a particular form of state machine. We're not talking about some generalized state machine capability here, and it's relatively simple. There aren't things like conditional guards on the transitions or anything like that. So again, with a domain-specific language, we can tailor it to produce not any kind of state machine, but the particular kind of state machine that we're interested in. Another little wrinkle is we have this notion of a reset event. Basically, that if we're trying to go through this sequence in the room and somebody opens the door to the room, the whole system kind of goes back to its idle state. Now, I threw that in because I wanted something that wasn't a normal part of state machine behavior. Again, to bring out the fact you're doing something very particular for this domain as opposed to something general for state machines. And this basic state machine is the one we're talking about. But obviously, if you were talking about this doing it in any kind of realistic situation, you'd want thousands of customers, and each customer would have its own state machine for their own particular secret panel. So the point here is what we want to be able to do is separate common code from particular code for a particular configuration. I think in the book I talk about how this is all going to run on, this is all designed to run on Java systems because we've got a big job lot of toasters from the .com crash. So they're all going to be running on these toasters around the world, everybody having their own version of the state machine. Now, if we're in the situation where we're selling thousands and thousands of toasters, each one programmed with a different configuration for how to operate a secret panel, but we have a lot of common code in order to communicate across systems and in order to provide the basic state machine behavior, the natural thing to do as a developer is to say, oh, I want to take that reusable common code and turn it into a common library or framework. And perhaps one of the most important points I try to get over when I'm talking about state machines, talking about DSLs, is really 90% of what's going on when we talk about DSLs are really just basically putting together a library or framework. When people talk about the advantages and wax lyrical about the advantages of DSLs, 90% of those advantages is just put it in a library or framework. Similarly, when people talk about the disadvantages of DSLs, like, oh my God, I've got 20 million DSLs I'm going to have to learn, that's going to be complicated. Again, 90% of that argument is frameworks or libraries. If you want to build a non-trivial software system these days, you have to spend a lot of your time figuring out how libraries and frameworks work for your particular situation. DSLs, the dirty secret about DSLs is they're not actually a very big deal. Most of the action is libraries and frameworks. The DSL part is just a little bit of nice little window dressing that makes the whole thing work a little bit more smoothly. There I am. 2 years of my life working on a book, and I trivialize it right away. So one of the things I stress is that DSLs aren't an alternative to libraries and frameworks. They fit in with libraries and frameworks. So if you were trying to build the system, you'd probably build a little framework that knows about state machines. So you have a state class and transition class and an event class and things of that kind. I don't go into the details of how this works. It is all on the book that's online. But the point is, you've got this framework, and in order to actually set up a particular state machine for a particular customer, what you do is you instantiate a bunch of state and transition and event objects and wire them together, and there's your running state machine. Now, this style of work is what some people in the object-oriented world refer to as an active object model notion, an idea that the behavior of the system, the program, as it were, is basically bunches of instances of objects connected to each other in a particular way. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be an object model, obviously. It can just be a straight-based data structure. You basically have a whole bunch of instances of records. They're wired together in a particular way, and the way in which they're instantiated and wired together determines the behavior of how the thing works. Some people call it data-driven programs, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing particularly new here. And if you were to do this, then you would need some configuration code to wire it all together, and that configuration code would look something like this. And this is the state machine that I showed a couple of slides earlier, and how you would configure it using the framework that I've put together. Now, there are a couple of points I like to bring out from this. The code, by the way, is Java, but it would look pretty much the same in C#. There's two issues that people commonly have with this kind of configuration code. The biggest issue, but not the one people most tend to worry about, is the fact that it doesn't really look like you're configuring a state machine here. The state machine-ness doesn't leap out at you. And this is a big deal, because when we're trying to figure out how a program works because we want to change it, we want to be able to understand it right away. If we have to spend time puzzling it out, then that's a problem. I always like to quote, I think, Steve McConnell, who said that reading something to puzzle out what's going on is a good thing for a detective novel. It's a bad thing for code. So the fact that this doesn't say state machine at you is an immediate problem. Yeah, we can figure it out. We're bright people. We'll suss it out. But there's a problem because it's not. We have to actually think. Thinking is bad. No, maybe not. The second problem is the one that most people tend to fixate on when they're talking about this, and that is that if you're programming this system in Java or C# or a language like that, in order to actually get this to run on your toaster, you've got to compile it. And that compilation step is often a big deal for people when they're doing this kind of configuration code. If we're thinking configuring database mappings or the flow of a web framework, people often say, oh, I want to be able to change that without recompiling. Fortunately, we have, for the last decade, had a standard answer to this problem, which, of course, is XML. Turn it into XML. And I picked that next to try and, again, get people familiar with the fact that, you know, there's no big deal here. We've been doing this for quite a while, wrapping a framework and how we configure it in a hunk of DSL. And the main reason that people like to do this is because that way they can now change it at runtime without having to do a recompile. There's also another advantage as well, in that the state machine nature of it is beginning to come out a little bit. We now begin to see states of transitions inside them, and it's beginning to come out. Although it's kind of hard to tell with all the angle brackets and the XML syntax. But a true domain-specific language looks something like this, where you've actually got rid of the extraneous noise material and you've come up with a language that really, really, I think, comes right out at you. And that's really where I'm trying to lead people to say that rather than use XML, which is kind of hard to follow, why not have a custom language like this, which is much easier to read and understand? It's quicker to write because it's less typing, but that's actually not the point. It's all about, can I read it and understand it clearly? And, of course, it's much more compact, which helps as well. But again, it's really all about ease of reading. And of course, most people are scared about doing this because of the fact that they're scared of writing parsers. I always joke that there's two reasons why people are scared of writing parsers. It's either because they didn't take the parser class at college and they therefore think that parsers are scary, or it's because they did take the parser class at college and they found that parsers are scary. And this is actually a very broad and important issue here. When people talk about domain-specific languages, and we're going to have to get to define them a bit in a moment, but when people talk about this stuff in the college world, it's always seen as this kind of very minor and boring subpart of real programming compilers. So when you learn how to use parser generator tools, you learn in the context of using them for a real programming language. Well, unfortunately, I think that's actually the cause of a lot of the problems. To knock up a parser using a parser generator for something simple is actually pretty easy, because most of the stuff that you had to learn that was complicated about parser generators and writing around parser, you don't actually have to deal with when you're writing it for a small language, which is small both in terms of its number of constructs and small in terms of the fact that you're not parsing million-line programs. So it alters the rules. And I was actually quite surprised when the code to process this took me the same amount of time to write as the code to process the XML. I did them both in the morning. And okay, I was using Antler, I'd used Antler before, but even so, I was pretty impressed, particularly since I actually tried out part of Antler I hadn't used before when I did it this time. So I still had a little bit of learning curve to go. So I like to make that point to people, to say, you know, parsers aren't necessarily that complicated as people think. And once you get the hang of using the parser generator, particularly a modern one like Antler, it's actually fairly straightforward to sling something together, and the result is way more readable. I'm actually toying of bringing this point out a little bit more by using a trick that I first saw Gilad Braha do at a talk at JAL, where he basically takes all of the noise characters in the XML and colors them red. You will have a little bit of punctuation in the custom code, because things like the end statement is really punctuation, but you get very little. But in the XML, of course, it's just a sea of noise characters that... I'm still in two minds as to whether it's actually worth making that point or not, or just the size difference is enough to show people. But this is one form of what traditionally people call a DSL. Though at this point, I just kind of leave it at that. Then I say, well, let's have a look at another rendering of this DSL. And this is not quite as clean as the custom syntax we saw earlier, but it's still pretty clean. The state transition-y nature, I think, comes out fairly well. And those of you that are in the know will recognize that that's actually all valid Ruby code. So the point here is to say, it's to really introduce the difference between what I call internal and external DSLs. So right off, I don't normally do this when I give a talk, but I'm going to make an apology right off for using the term internal DSL rather than embedded DSL. I know that term, embedded DSL, has been around a long time for in-language form of DSLs. The reason I don't use it is because the term embedded language can mean lots and lots of different things. People talk about VBA as an embedded language within Excel. And that's really a very different kind of animal to this kind of thing. So because of the confusion, I've used the internal external DSL. The difference being, with an external DSL, you use any syntax you like and you treat it with a parser. And with the internal DSL is really a particular idiomatic usage of one programming language. You're still writing in that host programming language, but you use only a subset of its features. You use it in a kind of pidgin way to get that same feel that you had with that you could get with the external DSL, so that you have this feeling as I'm programming. What you want to generate is this sense of I'm programming in a language that's specially written to write my kind of state machine, even though you're really programming in the host language, in this case Ruby. You still want to sort of fool yourself with that illusion. With the external DSL, you really are programming in a language specially designed for the purpose. But obviously, with an internal DSL, you've got some nice advantages from the fact that You can be in that host language. In particular, you don't have to learn all the parsing stuff about that. So this, at this point, and the debate between whether an external and internal DSLs, which one's best, etc., is, I think, quite an interesting one. There's good arguments on either side. I suspect we'll be having many of those arguments and discussions during the course of the next few days. As far as I'm concerned, I really want to try and provide, with my work, and I don't do very much of it with this talk, but certainly in the book, is to try and provide the tools to give both approaches a good start so that someone can get moving using whichever way they think is best for their circumstances. I'm kind of neutral between the two, I think. And, well, no, I'm in favour of one on Wednesdays and the other on Thursdays, and on Fridays I can't make up my mind. Now, in this view of the world, I see XML as an external DSL. And that's a little bit weird because, again, we have to conform to the XML syntax. I think of XML as a carrier syntax for your domain-specific language. And in a similar way, over here, Ruby is being a carrier syntax for your language as well. The real difference between the two, I think, comes in the fact that I think of an internal DSL as you're using the language you're usually programming in this very idiomatic and strange way. So if you're writing a Java program, you write Java in this odd kind of way, and that's why it's internal. With XML, it's definitely a separate thing. You can't write your entire system in XML, although it does sometimes seem as if some systems want to do that. There is a bit of a tricky boundary as to what happens if I'm going to, say, use a dynamic language specifically to act as an internal DSL like JRuby on top of a Java system, or maybe using IronRuby on top of C#. I still tend to think of it as internal. Perhaps the more important difference is the way we think about how parsing the language works. With an external DSL, we think about parsing in the traditional sense, in the sense that we're parsing strings, well, usually turned into tokens. In XML case, they get turned into XML elements, but we're still kind of working through that kind of data structure. While with an internal DSL, what we're effectively doing is we're parsing sequences of method calls, which is probably not how most people think about parsing, but maybe I've become strange as I'm beginning to think of working with external DSLs that way. So having sort of given that example, I then say, well, now we've got an internal DSL, and we say that's just our programming language. So is this first example, was that a DSL? I mean, after all, that was our programming language, right? What's the difference between that and the Ruby I just showed? Is it just because Ruby is a cool language, and therefore we call it an internal DSL, and we can't do that in Java? And the answer to that is no, I think we can. This is a Java version of it. And as you'll see, that is very weird, funky-looking Java. But it, I think, does begin to have that sense of we're looking at a kind of weird form of Java that's specifically designed for talking about this kind of state machine. It's not as clean as the Ruby, by any means, but it's not bad. And in the end, I think what's the crucial difference is what I call different styles of API. In that, when we're used to programming, certainly in the object-oriented world, and I realize the functional world is kind of, I'm completely ignoring the functional world here, but I think that's a whole other bag of worms that I don't want to bring into this discussion for most people I'm talking to. When we're working with an object-oriented system in general, we have this idea about how we build our APIs, which is our normal way of working. And one of the things about these APIs is that every method in the API should really make sense on its own. In the sense that, you know, if I want to understand how to use a particular class, I can read down the list of methods and I get a sense of, oh, here's all the different things I can do with this class. And each method should make sense and be named in such a way that it is kind of self-standing. The Fluent API style is different because the methods don't make sense on their own. They only make sense in the context of some kind of expression or sentence within the DSL language that we're talking about. The great example of this here is this to method. Now, if you just looked at a Java doc or an object browser and saw a method called to on a state class or whatever, you'd go, what the hell's that? It makes no sense. But in the context of, well, I call a transition method and then say to, then I get a sense of what it means, even though I haven't explained to you how it fits in. And that, I think, is the essence of the difference between an internal DSL and just any regular API, in that we think about it as we want to be able to compose sentences as opposed to just have a bunch of method calls here. And this is important because this is the first of the very awkward boundary conditions between what's a DSL and what isn't a DSL. If you get into any kind of pub discussion on this, you'll realize that there is no solid definition of what is or isn't a DSL. And at the boundaries are all sorts of areas of fuzziness. And for internal DSLs, that fuzziness is what's the difference between a regular API and an internal DSL. And I think what it comes down to is, do we have this sentence-like fluid kind of structure to it? And it's a very blurry, informal, not very precise kind of difference. But I think it does kind of pass the, what is it, the Miller test. I know it when I see it. Some things feel like a DSL. Some things definitely don't. And, of course, some things are kind of in the middle and you're not quite sure whether they are or they aren't. It also means that the rules of what makes a good API are different. So in this API, we're violating many rules that are very good rules to have for API designs for object-oriented programs. In particular, the command query separation that says that you shouldn't, that a method that returns a value shouldn't change the observable state of the object that you invoke it on. We're breaking that rule left, right, and center. And that's okay, I think. It's okay to break that rule for this particular circumstance, but you want to try and separate the fluent parts of the system from the regular command query side. So this question of what's the difference between an internal DSL and an API is kind of the first step that moves towards the question of how do you define a domain-specific language. This is the definition that I'm currently using in the book. And I've already talked about the first aspect of that, which is what I think of its language nature. A domain-specific language should have this language nature to it. And the command query API that I showed at the beginning doesn't have that linguistic language feel at all. It should be a computer programming language. It's kind of rather obvious, I guess, but say it anyway. The next point, though, is a little bit more interesting. I've talked so far about the boundary, the big boundary condition for internal DSLs, which is when is it an internal DSL and when is it just a regular API. There's another awkward boundary condition for external DSLs, which is what's the difference between an external DSL and a general purpose language? And here things get very interesting. Now, my favorite example that I tend to use for this is to think about this problem is a language called R. I don't know whether any of you have come across R. Some of you will have done, probably. It's a statistics language for an open source stats package, similar to SAS or SPSS. And basically, it contains within it fully flown, fully capable programming language that is specifically designed for dealing with statistics. That is, it is a language that is specific to the domain of statistics. So does that mean it's a DSL? Well, the problem then is, then why isn't Java a DSL? I mean, that's a language specific to the domain of programs running on the Java virtual machine. Why isn't C# a DSL? Because it's, you know, you follow the argument. Even C, you know, it's a specific language for, I mean, where's the boundary? I mean, you can argue about it, but the point is it's not a very useful distinction. And in fact, I think thinking about a domain-specific language as a language for a specific domain is actually the wrong way to think about it. I think the interesting thing about DSLs is that they have limited expressiveness. That is, a domain-specific language, at least in the sense that I'm using the term here, or as I'm defining the term here, doesn't allow you to do the kinds of things you'd expect a full-blown programming language to allow you to do. For a start, almost certainly it won't be Turing complete. I think it is possible to have domain-specific languages that are Turing complete, but you want to try and avoid it as much as possible. Accidental Turing completion has been the destruction of many a good domain-specific language. So most of them aren't Turing complete. The other thing you probably don't want in a domain-specific language is the ability to build, widely build your own abstractions. This is a very fundamental thing. I mean, in programming, what we're used to doing, I mean, in many ways you could describe the whole art of programming, is about building abstractions, gradually building up abstractions and assembling together to make programs that we can understand. The whole point of a domain-specific language is that you've got the abstraction that you want to work with right there in the DSL. You don't want to build new abstractions. There's some cases that within a certain limited sense, a certain limited amount of abstraction building might be needed, but most DSLs, I think, don't really give you very much abstraction building capabilities. The interesting thing, I think, in the end about DSLs is their limited power. External DSLs is the limited power. And even internal DSLs, what you say within the pigeon of the internal DSL is very limited. You're not using all the facilities of the host language, you're using this little subset. And if you step out of into using that full power of a language, you're really stepping out of the internal DSL. And with an external DSL, you have, well, there are ways to step out of a DSL, but they're much more complicated. The boundary is much clearer between what's in and what's out of the DSL. But this, I think, is the primary boundary for external DSLs. And it's a boundary that I think is useful to discuss. We can talk about the difference between limited expressiveness languages and general purpose languages. Now, a part of me has wondered whether I should actually even use the word domain-specific language in my book and my writing. Maybe I should go with the old Unix term mini-language or little language. But on the whole, I think, although I've kind of pushed away part of the definition of DSL in order to do this, I think it's the appropriate thing to do. Because although some people do like to use cool things like RDSLs, I think when you think of things in that way, you just lead yourself into confusion, or at least into an uninteresting state. So for the moment, I'm defining DSLs and saying limited expressiveness, knowing the fact that there are going to be people who are going to disagree with me about it. But then focused on a particular domain, that's really just a consequence of a limited expressiveness. If you've only got limited expressiveness, obviously you can't do everything in general, so you are inevitably going to be focused on a domain. But that's really a consequence of a limited expressiveness, not the fundamental thing of what a DSL is about. So that's the definition thing that I use. Yes?
I think you just said that the main purpose of a domain-specific language is not to be domain-specific?
I'm saying the fact that a domain-specific language is domain-specific is a consequence of its nature rather than its fundamental thing. I mean, we use lots of words in English where the literal meaning of the word is not what it actually means, right? So lots of phrases are like that, and I think that's the best way to think of DSLs. And I'm not saying the world necessarily thinks the way I do. I just happen to think that my way of thinking about the world is the best.
So if you turn it around, a limited expressive language that is not domain-specific is not very useful.
Yeah, it's not very interesting.
So it's a consequence that it's domain-specific because that means the combination makes it useful.
Yeah.
Is it useful to say that because the power of these languages, or one of the useful things about these languages, you can't build abstractions. Therefore, in order to be non-domain specific, you'd have to have all the abstractions of everything already defined, which you can't do up front, so therefore it becomes domain specific due to the lack of building abstractions, but that's a good thing.
Exactly, because you have constructed the abstraction you want to work with. There's also another very important point that comes from this, is that you are never going to have one domain specific language. Sometimes I hear people say, oh, we'll write a domain-specific language for the insurance domain, and then we'll write the computer system in this language. Fail. The notion is that if you're going to use domain-specific languages, you're always going to use many of them, usually in conjunction with one, or possibly even more than one, general-purpose language. So you use maybe 20 domain-specific languages for little parts of the system, and then a general-purpose language to pull them all together. And that's typically the way in which these things are used. You're never going to use just the one. There's an intriguing consequence of that, which is that domain-specific, you need to be able to compose different domain-specific languages together. And that's another area where the traditional compiler world is really lacking at the moment. Because most thinking in compilers is we have one grammar for our language, and we don't have a nice way to be able to compose completely independent grammars together in some interesting way. There's some work in the research areas working on this, but you try to do that with sort of relatively mainstream parser generator tools, and it's not easy. And it's not seemed to be a problem that's relatively high on the accepted list, as it were. I also like to point out around this point, usually a bit earlier actually, that the internal-external DSL division actually goes back a long, long way. I mean, the Unix world is kind of the land of the external DSLs, where whenever you want to do anything with Unix, you create a little mini language and get out Lex and Yak and do it in there. The internal DSL has the same long history, particularly in the Lisp community. Lispers always talk about growing a language to solve the problem in Lisp and then using that language to solve the problem. And of course, the Lispers don't worry about the fact that they're limited to using a carrier syntax of Lisp, because Lisp is the perfect programming language. Why would you want to use anything else anyway? As Kevlin Henney said, that small talkers believe that they have the best programming language. Lispers believe they have the perfect programming language. Okay, so that's, I think, an important point both in the normal and in the meta discussion. The definition that I like to work with for DSLs. The next point is something that I kind of hinted at a little bit earlier on, and now going to bring more to fruition, which is this notion that whenever you see a domain-specific language, you usually, or at least you should usually, see a framework or library. And I think of that framework or library as a model, a data model or an object model, but is effectively the semantics of our domain-specific language. So I'm using the term semantic model for this. I could use the term domain model, but domain model has a particular connotation that it is in the object-oriented world, that it's a rich object model. And semantic models may be just a data structure. I mean, it could be just a bunch of C data structures pointing around. Obviously, a lot of the Unix little language semantic models are like that. But the notion is that we have a model that captures how we want things to work. And what's really going on with a DSL is it's just a way of a nice, comfortable front end to configure that model with, to instantiate the necessary objects and wire them together. And one of the things that I try to encourage, what I very much want to encourage people to do, is to think of a separation between the model and the language, and to make that separation explicit. That is, whatever you're trying to do, build the model and build your language and let them both evolve independently. I think it simplifies the task to separate the two out, and it also particularly simplifies testing. So in the state machine example, the semantic model is the model I talked about early on of states and events and transitions and things of that kind. I can build that model, I can test that model completely independently of any DSL that I use to populate it with. Then as a completely separate exercise, I can build one, or indeed many, DSLs that populate that model. And each of those models is parsed in the sense that it populates the model. And so I'm treating here parsing as the endpoint of parsing is a populated semantic model. And I can test the parsing independently of testing the state machine behavior itself. And I think that's a very useful separation to do. Yes?
Consider the semantic model the data structure or the classes or the OO representation of the data in the running program, or
yes,
the abstract syntax of your language?
The running program. This is not a syntax tree. Well, at least not always a syntax tree. Usually not.
Because then my second question, and that was where I was getting at, is
what do you think about environments like in embedded systems where you really don't have that because you can't afford it? You really generate low-level C code from your language.
We haven't talked about code generation yet, so hold that thought.
Okay.
So the semantic model, the one point I do want to stress is semantic model is not the syntax tree, usually. Now, if we were talking arithmetic expressions, then I think that a syntax tree is a logical semantic model for that. But if thinking again about parsing the state machine example, the semantic model is the instances of the states and transition objects connected together in some nice network structure. But the syntax tree is going to be some tree of nodes representing names of states that need symbol tables to actually tie the things together. So they're two quite different data structures. And my argument is it's the semantic model that people should really concentrate on. The syntax tree is just part of the way of getting there. And obviously for every different DSL you have, you'll have a different syntax tree, potentially at least, to make that same semantic model. Now, I'm not saying this separation is necessarily widely done. Certainly with external DSLs, I commonly see people who have code generation in their grammar files. And yes, that's very common. I would never want to write something that way. I think it's going to be much easier to populate a model and then work off that model. And when I say work off that model, there's two ways to work off that model. One is to execute the model. I instantiate a bunch of state objects and tweak them, and they execute the way objects do. Or if it's a data structure, I have some other program that interprets the model and does all that kind of thing, interpretation. Or we can talk about code generation. And that's coming to the point that Marcus made. So when we generate code, then that code can be whatever it's generated. It could have a model embedded into it or not. But the point is the code should be generated off the semantic model, not off the DSL script in the part of the parsing process. And I think that's advantageous because it makes the code generation a lot easier to do. It allows independent testing. I can simulate the generated code in the semantic model, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in short, I really go on and on ad nauseum about the importance of semantic models at the center of this. I think it's really quite useful to making DSLs work effectively. Okay. So the next topic I then move on to, noticing we've got to watch for time, is language workbenches. Chris.
So going back to your previous point, what do you tell people in terms of, when you say code generation is optional, what do you tell them to do instead? Do you tell them to...
I tell them if you don't have to use code generation, don't do it. But if you have to use code generation, do it. Right? It's going to depend on your environment, right? I've got an embedded system to run in. I can only, I have to be doing C, code generate. Or I'm going to execute my system by generating SQL code to run directly on a database, generate it. But on the other hand, if I'm creating a .NET system and I've got a bunch of .NET objects, why generate a bunch of C#? Just run the friggin' C#, right? So usually... And the reason I make a big fuss about this is because I've read so much stuff that people have written about DSLs and similar ideas where code generation seems to be treated as an absolute, that you have to generate code. But I remember giving this talk recently to someone and said, I never thought you could use DSLs and not have to generate code. So I really want to kind of knock that idea on the head because many of the best DSLs don't do any code generation. Okay, language workbenches. My God, I've got to keep going here fast. So language workbenches are basically various sophisticated tools out there that will help you create and use domain-specific languages. They give you the tools to be able to define semantic models. They give you, in particular, the ability to have a rich editing environment in which to work with the DSL scripts. And the rich editing environment is probably... the most interesting thing to talk about in that. Now, in there comes an important distinction. In the way in which we think about editing programs. So we have this approach called source editing. It's weird. Where we start with source code, which is ASCII text, and we run a compiler on it, and we get our executing system. That's the way which most people tend to think about the way programming works. Write source, run a compiler or run an interpreter and get an executing system. Many language workbenches operate in a different mode, where you have a model repository and you project out the various views of what's going on in that model repository for you to edit. So, yesterday I was at Intentional Software, and they wanted to flaunt their software at me. So what they did is that they put that state model into their model repository, the semantic model, and then they created projections for the custom code, the XML and the Ruby, and they would just project it out. And if you wanted to change, you just change the menu item. Show it me as Ruby, show it me as custom, show it me as XML. You know, that is the projectional notion. Take whichever view you like. Now, one of the great advantages of projectional notion is that you can use graphics. So these screenshots were grabbed from MetaEdit. Intentional also showed me doing some graphics as well. And you can actually manipulate graphics and modify the system that way. It's very hard to do source editing with graphics. I've never, in fact, it may be impossible. I've never seen anyone do source editing with graphics. I'm not quite sure how one would do it. But if you're going to do graphical input and manipulation, a projectional approach makes a lot of sense. And then the model generates the running system pretty much as I talked about early on. Now, I tend to think of language workbenches as the third stream of DSLs. There's internal DSLs and external DSLs, and they've been around for longer than I've been programming. Language workbenches, though, are very, very new. Of that list, rapid list I showed earlier on, MetaEdit has got some stuff in production, but it's not hugely widely used. The other systems are still hoping to get stuff in production at some point. Actually, I think JetBrains may have at least some of their stuff internally in production. But it's still fairly new territory. But it's very, very interesting territory. If the language workbenches pull off their promise, they could change the face of programming as we know it, in a good way. And so therefore, I think they're really, really interesting. And it's taking a long time for them to kind of get stuff going. And it's going to be a big shift for programmers to get used to the idea of what these tools look like and even what languages look like with these tools. But the result could really be quite startling. And, God, what don't we? I'll leave that for a bit, the last point on that. So then I finish off my talk by saying, okay, now I've gone through what DSLs look like, why should we use them? And I'll use this to illustrate one reason we should use DSLs, is because for geeks who know the DSL, a DSL is a very appropriate way to describe a particular situation. And if you know regular expressions, that is way more readable than what the equivalent code would be if you actually did it through imperative code. Right? Okay, you've got to know regular expressions in order to understand what that says, but if you do, that just makes you a hell of a lot more productive to be able to use it. And anyone who's uses regular expressions as part of their work on a regular basis, think of giving up regular expressions. Oh, my God, right? We wouldn't want to do that. And again, with all the other geek-oriented DSLs that we have. And I think that on its own is a good enough reason to be interested in DSLs. They provide us an ability to be more intention-revealing, a bit more productive in our software development. But the real benefit, the real kicker, is in examples like this. This is CSS. A lot of people who write CSS don't think of themselves as programmers. They think of themselves as web designers. CSS is actually not the greatest example. It's the best I could think of to put on the slide. The real benefit, really nice thing about DSLs is, do they provide a mechanism by which we can actually engage non-programmers much more involved in the process? Now, a lot of people think that what that means is business people writing their own rules. And whenever people say that to me, I think, yeah, that was what COBOL was supposed to be. But the point is, you don't have to be able to write to make it beneficial. The key thing is that they can read and take part in the process, that you can show them, here is the code that runs your insurance rules. Does that make sense? And they say, oh, no, and scribble on it or something like that. Now, okay, with sophisticated tools like language workbenches, it's much more possible that they could actually be writing and changing things themselves. Although the thought that they would do so without any programmer intervention whatsoever, I'll believe it when it happens. But the main thing is improving the communication path between business people and developers. And that is the biggest bottleneck in software at the moment. So that's the thing where I think where DSLs are particularly interesting. And that's what makes me excited about the topic. And he's about to stop me from speaking, but he may let you ask a question if he's really, really nice.
Say that one application of DSL that I've noticed that has been very well established and very successful is in the gaming industry.
Yes.
Where you have, you know, engines like the Quake Engine run Unreal Tournament that have DSLs embedded in them that allow non-developers to express both, you know, designs and actions and, you know, sort of create and extend that platform using DSLs. So not just business people.
Yeah. Well, business people, sorry, I'm using that term. I really mean domain people, and I just get sometimes flubbered because I usually talk right in business software terms. Another point that's quite important as well is that when we're talking about language workbenches, the notion of what it means to be a language is something kind of different, because you can fold in the execution of the code with the definition of the code. And the great example of a general purpose system that does that is a spreadsheet. A spreadsheet as a programming language. Well, maybe not. But the point is, I think if language workbenches take off, the DSLs they will produce will be more like spreadsheets than what we currently think of as DSLs.
So, Martin, I was about to cut you off, but it's my conference, so I'm going to ask a question instead.
Okay.
I saw a very crisp definition of DSLs. I missed the definition of language workbench.
And that's because I'm not quite sure at the moment how to define it. I came up with a definition several years ago when I wrote about them originally, based on what I saw from the intentional MPS and Microsoft DSL tool platforms. But the Oslo stuff and Xtext don't conform to that definition, but I think are what I'm imagining as language workbenches. They are tools that allow you to build DSLs with integrated editing environments for them, et cetera, et cetera. So the definition is going to be something like a tool that allows you to build domain-specific languages with rich editing environments for those languages, something like that. But I haven't figured out what the crisp definition is yet.
Great. Thank you very much, Martin Fowler.